When you think about building this massive state-of-the-art skyscraper, you probably picture this like pristine structure.
Right, made of the most advanced, beautiful glass you've ever seen.
Exactly. But imagine taking that absolute masterpiece and building it directly on top of a shifting active fault line.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, it might be a stunning piece of architecture, but the ground underneath is fundamentally unstable.
Right.
You're forced to constantly balance this, incredible architectural ambition with the very real, very sudden threat of total collapse.
Yes, exactly. And that exact tension, building higher and faster while the ground underneath shakes, that is exactly what reading through today's stack of sources felt like.
It really was a wild read.
It was.
Yeah.
So welcome to this custom deep dive crafted just for you. Today, we are immersing ourselves in the Tech & Knight intelligence briefing for Monday, August 17th, 2026.
And it's a massive day of breaking news.
Oh, massive. We've got stuff across gaming, semiconductor evolution, and cybersecurity. So our mission today, really, is to explore this fascinating intersection where boundary-pushing technological ambition collides head-on with, well, terrifyingly sophisticated vulnerability.
Yeah, it really is a profound juxtaposition. I mean, the briefing today proves we are currently in an era where technological excellence thrives right at the intersection of creative daring and uncompromising security.
Right.
We are pushing the absolute limits of what digital entertainment and like pocket-sized hardware can do. But we're simultaneously having to defend against adversaries who are weaponizing that very same complexity.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's start with the creative daring side of things, specifically in interactive entertainment.
Software catching up to ambition, basically.
Exactly. And the biggest proof of that is the news out of Activision and Infinity Ward today. They are breaking two decades of franchise tradition with the public beta for Call of Duty Modern Warfare 4.
Yeah, this is huge.
It's unheard of. They aren't just giving us a couple of multiplayer maps. They are dropping a complete standalone single-player campaign story mission into the public beta.
The Arctic clandestine raid.
Right, with Task Force 141. To me, this is like, it's like a massive movie studio giving away the entire climax of their summer blockbuster as the trailer.
That's a really good way to put it.
It's totally wild. I have to wonder, is this just a massive technological flex to apologize for, the heavily criticized truncated campaign we got in Modern Warfare 3 back in 2023?
And what's fascinating here is the sheer level of executive confidence this move demonstrates.
Oh, totally.
Because you have to remember, historically, betas for games like Cold War or MW2, they only featured multiplayer modes.
Just to stress test servers, right?
Right. Stress test the back end, balance the gunplay. Putting a highly polished narrative slice out there early, I mean, that's a massive risk if the game isn't completely ready.
Yeah, if it bugs out, you ruin the launch.
Exactly. But they are using this specific mission to showcase their proprietary IW10 rendering engine. They are pushing real-time volumetric destruction of concrete and metallic structures during actual gameplay.
Wow.
And they are running this at a locked 60 frames per second at native 4K resolution.
With the full path trace reflections, right?
Yes, on the new consoles and high-end PCs.
Wait, pause for a second, because we hear path tracing thrown around in gaming marketing like a buzzword all the time. But what is actually happening inside the machine when that's turned on?
That's a great question.
And why is it such a flex to have it running at 60 FPS in 4K?
Well, traditional video game lighting uses tricks. Developers essentially bake shadows and light sources into the environment, so it looks realistic, but it's largely an illusion.
Like painting a shadow on the floor.
Exactly. Path tracing, on the other hand, is a fully simulated physical process. The game engine is literally calculating the exact paths of millions of individual rays of light in real time. Millions. It simulates how light bounces off snow, reflects off a metallic gun barrel, or refracts through glass, all simultaneously. It is computationally incredibly heavy.
And they're doing that while the building is blowing up.
Right. When you combine that with real-time volumetric destruction, meaning a concrete pillar doesn't just play a pre-animated breaking sequence.
It shatters uniquely.
Exactly, based on exactly where the bullets hit it.
Yeah.
You are demanding an astronomical amount of processing power.
That's insane.
They know they have a technical marvel on their hands. And by letting players experience that uncompromising realism early, they are just driving record-breaking digital pre-orders.
It really is wild to think about that level of physics rendering, because if you look back, I mean, this is something developers have been chasing for decades.
Oh, absolutely.
There's this newly uncovered archival interview in today's stack with a former Rockstar Games developer that just blew my mind.
Oh, the GTA physics revelation.
Yeah. They revealed that back in the day, they had actually built hyper-realistic AI physics and shootable architectural pillars for the legacy Grand Theft Auto games.
Right, but they had to cut them entirely.
Because they were just too problematic for the processing limits of the old consoles, the hardware simply couldn't do the math fast enough.
Right. I mean, it would have choked the CPU of a PlayStation 2 or an Xbox 360 to a halt. It would have completely melted the system.
Yeah, the software ambition was there, but the silicon wasn't.
Exactly. And now, these are the exact environmental physics expected to reach full commercial maturity in the upcoming Grand Theft Auto the Sixth.
So, okay, if rendering just one falling concrete pillar used to physically melt older consoles, how on earth are we supposed to run these modern physics engines on a device that literally folds in half in my pocket?
Right, which leads us directly into the mobile hardware leaks from the Android Authority piece today.
Yes, the Samsung news. So Samsung is drastically pivoting its 2027 foldable roadmap to release two distinct wide-fold models.
Yeah, shifting away from their old designs.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets really interesting, because I have to question Samsung's core motivation here. Are they doing this out of pure innovation, or are they just panicking because of the rumored Apple iPhone Fold?
That's the big question.
Because Apple's concept is projected to be this sub-9-millimeter device running a powerhouse A20 Pro chip. And let's be honest about the current foldable market. Older foldables, with their narrow 22.9 or 23.9 aspect ratios,
Maybe you're awkward.
they frankly felt like you were trying to text on a TV remote. It
Yes.
was incredibly awkward.
Yeah.
But this new 20.9 outer display standard Samsung is adopting, that feels like holding a totally normal premium smartphone that just happens to secretly hide a tablet inside.
Yeah, your skepticism is totally warranted. The Apple rumors are absolutely a massive catalyst forcing their hand here.
They have to compete.
They have to. But looking at the engineering, Samsung is finalizing to solve what they call that narrow display friction. It's a monumental leap in hardware mechanics.
Okay, so what are they actually changing under the hood?
To achieve that sub-9-millimeter folded profile, they are implementing a gapeless Grade 5 titanium hinge.
Titanium, okay.
But more importantly, to your point about not melting the device while running these massively complex game engines, they're powering these wide folds with a custom 3-nanometer Snapdragon Gen 6 chip.
3 nanometers. I mean, the transistors are getting so small, we're almost at the atomic level.
It's mind-boggling.
But all that power generates heat. So how do you prevent a foldable glass and titanium sandwich from thermal throttling the second you boot up a high-end game?
Well, they are pairing that 3-nanometer silicon with ultra-wide vapor chambers.
Okay, what does that actually mean?
The mechanics of a vapor chamber are actually brilliant. It's essentially a sealed, flat, copper enclosure containing a tiny amount of liquid
Inside the phone.
inside the phone. When the processor gets hot, that liquid absorbs the heat and transitions into a vapor.
Oh, wow.
That vapor then travels to the cooler areas of the chamber, dissipates the heat, condenses back into a liquid, and travels back to the processor via capillary action.
So it's a continuous loop.
Exactly. A continuous microscopic cooling loop.
Yeah.
By making these chambers ultra-wide across the device, they're rapidly dissipating heat across a much larger surface area.
Right.
It's specifically designed to stop gaming thermal throttling.
They are essentially putting console-level liquid-to-gas thermal management into a folding piece of glass.
It really is amazing engineering.
It is. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, we are basically carrying our entire financial, social, and gaming lives on these ultra-thin titanium glass slabs.
Which brings us to the vulnerabilities.
Yes, which means malicious actors are building equally sophisticated tools to bypass our defenses. And if we look at the bleeping computer warning in today's stack, it is genuinely alarming.
Really is.
There's a new macOS Trojan out there called Amnesia Stealer. It's disguising itself as cracked video editors and developer tools on GitHub.
Right.
And when I was reading the mechanics of this, I was genuinely shocked. If a user has multi-factor authentication, MFA set up, which, you know, we're all told is the gold standard.
So this would be foolproof.
Right. How on earth is this malware completely bypassing it? Because it feels like instead of a thief trying to fake an ID at the front door of an exclusive club, they are just sneaking in and stealing the VIP wristband directly off your wrist while you're already inside having a drink.
That is the perfect analogy. It really highlights exactly how the mechanism works, because the VIP wristband in this scenario is what we call a session cookie.
Okay.
And this raises an important question about how we view digital security today, because most people still think a strong password, backed up by a code texted to their phone, is the ultimate fortress.
Right. That's what we've been taught.
But session cookie theft completely sidesteps that fortress.
How exactly? Like, what is a session cookie mechanically?
So when you log into a website and successfully pass your MFA prompt, your browser doesn't want to force you to re-authenticate every single time you click a new link on that site.
Oh, yeah, that'd be terrible.
Right. So the server creates an active authentication token, which is just a small text file called a session cookie, and it stores it in your browser.
Okay, so it remembers you.
Exactly. Amnesia Stealer is designed to locate and extract those active token files.
Oh, wow.
And it also specifically targets Web3 crypto wallet extensions like MetaMask or Phantom.
Just grabs them right out of the browser?
Yeah. It extracts the recovery seed phrases directly from the local browser storage. Then the attackers take those stolen session cookies and inject them into their own web browsers.
So the server thinks it's you.
Precisely. When they navigate to the site, the host server sees that valid token and assumes they are you, already authenticated, already inside the club. No password or MFA is ever requested.
Wait, but how is the malware even getting onto a Mac in the first place? I thought Apple's gatekeeper security automatically blocked unsigned or suspicious applications from running.
Yeah, that's where the evasion tactics get highly sophisticated. The malware bypasses gatekeepers by using stolen, cryptographically valid Apple developer certificates.
You're kidding.
So to the operating system, the application looks completely legitimate and signed by a trusted developer.
So it just walks right past the bouncer.
Pretty much. And once it's running, it doesn't just ping a suspicious server that your firewall might catch.
Mm-hmm.
It uses encrypted Telegram bots as command and control tunnels to quietly exfiltrate the stolen cookies.
So it blends its theft right into normal messaging traffic.
Exactly.
So what is the fix here? I mean, if MFA doesn't stop it, and Apple's built-in security thinks the app is legitimate, how does a user actually defend themselves?
Well, this is why security teams are urging you to routinely and manually log out of critical accounts.
Just clicking the log out button.
Yeah, it sounds too simple, but manually logging out is a specific server command. It forces the host server to permanently invalidate that session token.
Oh, I see.
So even if the malware stole your wristband, the moment you log out, that wristband becomes totally useless to the attacker.
Okay, so the individual user is highly vulnerable, but at least there's mitigation. What really gave me whiplash reading this briefing, though, is that the massive institutional pillars aren't faring any better.
No, they're not. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it isn't just our personal wristbands being stolen.
Right. It's one thing when one person's wristband is stolen, but the enterprise cloud infrastructure holding up the entire global economy is actively under siege.
Exactly. If adversaries are bypassing our personal security that easily, imagine what happens when they target the foundation of the digital club itself. The scale of these institutional attacks is just staggering.
Let's look at the cloud sector first. The Hacker News reported on an advanced persistent threat campaign targeting enterprise VMware vCenter servers.
Yeah, the Babook attack.
Right. And the report notes they're exploiting an unauthenticated remote code execution flaw in the ESIC Linux kernels, deploying a mutated version of Babook ransomware. Let's break that down, because those are a lot of dense, scary buzzwords. What exactly are they attacking here?
They are attacking the hypervisor.
Okay, what is that?
A hypervisor isn't just a regular server operating system. It is the foundational layer of code that allows multiple separate virtual machines, sometimes hundreds of them, to share the hardware of a single physical server.
Right, because normally you'd think hackers have to breach individual virtual desktops one by one to cause damage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To use an analogy, a hypervisor attack isn't like a thief picking the lock on 50 individual apartment doors to steal what's inside.
Right.
It's like the thief sneaking into the leasing office and stealing the master deed to the entire building.
Oh, that's terrifying.
By compromising the hypervisor layer, the attackers bypass the virtual machines entirely. They go straight for the underlying container.
And the ransomware encrypts the raw virtual machine disk images, the .vmdk files?
Yes.
And the briefing says it does this in milliseconds. It instantly paralyzes entire corporate fabrics. But wait. What does it mean when the report says the ransomware is mutated? How does code mutate?
Well, it's using polymorphic code. Every time the ransomware infects a new system, it automatically rewrites portions of its own underlying signature without changing its core function.
That hides itself.
Right. Traditional antivirus software looks for known static signatures. It's like looking for a specific license plate on a getaway car.
Gotcha.
But mutated ransomware changes its license plate, its paint job, and its make and model every time it deploys.
Wow.
It evades automated detection, gets into the hypervisor, and locks the building's master deed before the security team even knows there's a breach.
It's a complete structural failure. So how are enterprise administrators actually responding to this?
Well, they're being forced into strict, air-gapped, zero-trust network isolation.
Which means what exactly in practice?
It means assuming the network is already breached. Zero-trust requires every single internal request for access to be heavily verified, regardless of where it comes from. But air-gapped isolation goes a step further. Administrators are literally having to physically or logically cut off their central management interfaces from the broader corporate network just to survive.
So unplugging it, basically.
Essentially, yeah. If the hypervisor isn't connected to the main network, the remote exploit can't reach it. It's a radical shift toward extreme defensive postures.
And speaking of structural failures and radical shifts in behavior, we have to talk about the fallout in the crypto space.
Yes, the Binance situation.
Yeah. Sure. Now, just to be incredibly clear to you listening, we are not taking any sides on the government's actions here.
Right, definitely not.
Nor are we endorsing or condemning the broader cryptocurrency debate. Our goal is strictly to examine the technological and behavioral fallout detailed in today's CoinDesk investigation.
Absolutely. We're just looking at the data.
Exactly. So the report exposes that Binance, which is the world's largest centralized exchange, handed over user compliance data to state law enforcement, which resulted in arrests. So what does this all mean? Because this has ignited a massive migration of retail and institutional traders. They are fleeing centralized exchanges, or CEXs, and moving toward decentralized exchanges, or DEXs, like Uniswap and Hyperliquid.
It's a massive shift.
For anyone who isn't living and breathing crypto, what is the actual mechanical difference between a centralized exchange and a decentralized exchange, and why does this provide security?
Well, the mechanical difference really comes down to who holds the keys and where the trade actually happens.
Okay.
On a centralized exchange like Binance or Coinbase, mm-hmm. you don't actually hold your crypto. You deposit it into their corporate wallets,
yeah.
and their internal private database credits your account.
So it's essentially an IOU.
Exactly.
So they have full custody of the assets and full custody of your identity data?
Precisely. You have to provide your passport, your ID, your address, and all of that is held in a central corporate server.
Right.
A decentralized exchange, or DEX, operates entirely differently. There is no central database. There is no corporation holding your funds.
So how does it work?
A DEX is just a series of automated smart contracts running openly on the blockchain. When you trade on Uniswap, you connect your own self-custody wallet,
yep.
you execute a trade directly against a liquidity pool governed by code, and the new asset goes straight back into your personal wallet.
So there is no central compliance office to hand over your data because there is no central office at all.
Exactly. You maintain absolute custody of your funds at all times.
Okay, so that explains the migration.
Right. What this Binance fallout shows is a behavioral tipping point. Both of these institutional events erode trust in centralized systems.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Users are migrating their liquidity to DEXs to preserve their financial privacy, signaling a massive rejection of centralized vulnerability. When a central point of failure is exposed, whether it's a corporate compliance office handling your data or a single hypervisor managing your corporate cloud,
behavior shifts radically.
Exactly, towards self-preservation and decentralization.
Man, it has been an absolute whiplash of a day for August 17th, 2026.
That's for sure.
I mean, we started at the absolute peaks of creative ambition, experiencing the incredibly computationally heavy path-traced storytelling of the Modern Warfare 4 campaign beta.
And marveling at the phase transition thermal engineering of Samsung's titanium-wide foldables.
Right, so much amazing tech. But then we plunge straight into the deep anxieties of our time. Polymorphic ransomware locking up corporate hypervisors in milliseconds.
And session hijacking Trojans quietly stealing our VIP wristbands.
It really is that brilliant glass skyscraper built right on top of a fault line.
It is. And, you know, looking at all these sources together, it leaves us with a critical, almost philosophical question to consider.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we've seen that our most robust individual security measures, like MFA, can be entirely bypassed by simply stealing a tiny session cookie file.
Right.
And we've seen our biggest centralized platforms, whether it's VMware for enterprise cloud hosting or Binance for global finance, are ultimately vulnerable to devastating structural exploits or state data demands.
Yeah, they're massive targets.
So the question is, are we rapidly approaching a future where the era of centralized convenience is dead?
Wow.
Will we soon be forced to return to fully localized, self-hosted hardware and completely decentralized, trustless networks just to ensure our basic safety and privacy?
That is a heavy but vital question to mull over. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the bleeding edge of the interactive frontier.
It's been fascinating.
We really hope this exploration gave you some valuable analytical depth and helped explain not just what is happening in the tech world, but exactly how it all works. As the Tekken editorial board advised, have a restful and inspiring night.
And the next time you log into a crucial service, maybe take an extra second to manually log back out.
Good night, and watch out for those shifting fault lines.